listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's Friday, so that means it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting taking your calls. And, Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. There's a lot going on in the Congress and all around the country. Where would you like to start?
Well, let me start off with a piece that appeared in the Washington Post just the other day, and it talked about an issue that I think is the most profound issue that we have to deal with as a nation. Well, the issue was about Sheldon Adelson, who is a Republican billionaire, and how Republican candidates or people thinking about running for president are kind of going up to him, and he is assessing their strengths, because if they get his support, if one of them gets his support, they will in turn get tens and tens or hundreds of millions of dollars for race. And that speaks to the whole issue of income and wealth inequality and the impact it's having not only on our moral sense of who we are, more and more millionaires and billionaires, while we have the highest, more people living in poverty than ever before, but it speaks to what is happening to our political process. And what's happening to our political process is people like Sheldon Adelson, people like the Koch brothers, have the capability and are prepared to spend hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, on the political process to elect candidates who will give more tax breaks to the wealthy, who will cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and education. In other words, this whole business is undermining the fundamentals of American democracy, and it's an issue that we have got to pay very strong attention to.
I heard last on TV that the amount of money that Shelley Adelson gave in the last campaign cycle, which maintained a couple of these Republican candidates throughout the primaries,
right,
was the equivalent of $88 to an average American in terms of the impact on his net wealth.
Right.
It's incredible.
Well, here's what you got to understand. Using just the Koch brothers' wealth went from $68 billion to $80 billion in 1 year.
Wow.
$12 billion increase in wealth. Sheldon Adelson also did extraordinarily well. Barack Obama and Mitt Romney each spent a little bit over $1 billion in their presidential campaigns. So if you are the Koch brothers, if you feel passionately about the need to give more tax breaks for the rich and to cut programs for working families, and if you're prepared to spend as much as it takes to elect right-wing extremists in the House, in the Senate, to the White House, governor's seats, what do you think $1 billion or $2 billion is? You made $12 billion more last year.
Right.
So it is like, you know, you spring in for a cup of coffee for somebody. These guys have unlimited sums of money, and they can now use that money on the electoral process, which means never-ending negative ads. It means setting up all kinds of phony think tanks and other types of organizations. Koch brothers are all over the place. You talk about health care. You talk about the law. You talk about veterans issues. You talk about climate change. They have all kinds of organizations out there talking the right-wing position. And, you know, this is an issue we're going to have to get our hands around.
Yeah, yeah. Brought to you by our Supreme Court.
Brought to you by our Supreme Court. Now, so that's one issue, and that is the growing inequality of wealth and income and what it means to the political process. What's going on right now in the Senate is we are preparing a fairly aggressive legislative agenda, which we hope will speak to the needs of working Americans. And the first bill that we think will come up, and we got a shot to pass it now, I think a good shot in the Senate, and that's something you and I have talked about many times, is that is the need to extend long-term unemployment benefits. Republicans resisted. Finally, we now have, we think, at least five Republicans who are prepared to come on board. You have 55 members of the Democratic caucus, equals 60 votes, and our ability to overcome a filibuster. So that's where we are. That will be an extension, I believe, for 5 months going retroactively back into January. Then the problem we're going to have, of course, is dealing with John Boehner and the Republicans who control the House, who are going to fight us tooth and nail on this. But if we can pass it in the Senate, I am not sure that in an election year you may not get a number of may not be able to get a number of Republicans to support it in the House. So we're on the verge of doing something important. Right now you have over 2 million unemployed workers, long-term unemployed workers who are running out of money, who will be benefited by this legislation, and I hope we can pass it this week. The next item up is raising the minimum wage. We've also talked about that a whole lot nationally. Minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. We want to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Not enough, but a good start. It would mean a raise for some 20-plus million Americans, not just those people under $10.10 an hour, but there'll be a boost, you know, for people who are making now $10 an hour to $11 an hour. It also deals with a real scandal out there, and that is the tipped employees. If you are a waitress or a waiter or working primarily for tips, in many cases you do not get the minimum wage plus tips. You get substantially less than the minimum wage, and you hope to make up the difference with tips. Many of these workers do not, so we address that issue in the bill as well. Then in the following weeks, we're going to deal with pay equity. Women are making 70, 75 cents of what men are making. We want to address that issue. An issue that is all over the place that people feel very, very strongly about is the high cost of college. And we've got to figure out a way to make college affordable for working families and for the middle class. There are a variety of ideas out there. People want to express their views on that. I'd love to hear from them. That's an issue that we're going to address. Tom, one area where in a fairly pessimistic political moment in American history where we have won a huge victory, and it speaks to grassroots organizing, is, as you will recall, two and a half years ago, everybody was talking about how we had to cut Social Security through a chain CPI, et cetera, et cetera. And you had Wall Street billionaires like Pete Peterson spending hundreds of millions of dollars to cut Social Security. You had every Republican talking about it. You had a number of Democrats. You had the President of the United States. Well, we won. We stopped it. No one's talking about that anymore. In fact, now the discussion, more appropriately, is how do we expand Social Security? When you got half of the American people who have savings of $10,000 or less, how are people going to be able to deal with retirement with inadequate Social Security benefits? So we're going to be talking about how we expand Social Security, put more retirement benefits in the hands of working families. We also are going to be addressing the issue of the exploitation of our jobs, giving tax breaks to companies who use these tax breaks to shut down plants in America and move abroad. An issue that I am keenly concerned about is a massive jobs program to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, transform our energy system, create jobs doing that. So there's a pretty ambitious agenda that we're going to be bringing forward, and I hope that we can work with grassroots America in the fight to expand the middle class and raise wages.
Well, and this is really where it's at, is getting, you know, this populist message, getting people active.
Right. I think too often what the Democratic leadership has been about is doing their work for better or for worse. Sometimes it's good, sometimes not so good, but doing it inside Capitol Hill. And that is not going to work. We have got to mobilize millions and millions of people. The polls are very clear. The vast majority of the people understand that we need to raise the minimum wage. Vast majority of the people understand that we need a significant jobs program to create millions of jobs. We have youth unemployment today. Very few people talk about it. Youth unemployment today is close to 20%. And we've got to put those young people and others back to work through a major jobs program.
Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. He will be taking your calls right after the break. And for the rest of the hour, it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman Program, 15 minutes before after the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter there. It's a really good news source. And welcome back. In Yucca Valley, California, watching Free Speech TV, it's the KISS Kid. Really? Hello?
Yuck, Tom. My name's Archie. I just
okay.
changed to an acronym. Keep it simple, stupid. I always told myself I was brought up
okay.
with that.
You're on the air
Anyhow,
with Senator Sanders.
We've spoke many times. I think we need to update the corporate charter rules. You know, they got to clean up their waste, got to close up these loopholes, the Clean Air Water Act, rules against playing states against each other by corporations, tariffs for selling shell their products they make out of the country to shell companies that they own to avoid paying taxes. They're doing harm, and I thought that was the essence of corporate charter. I hope I did that in a minute, guys.
Okay.
Have a great day.
Well, thank you very much, Archie. I think if we're talking about, you know, what needs to happen in America, we need to mount a major offensive against the greed and recklessness and often illegal behavior, not just of Wall Street, but of corporate America as well. The fact is that one out of four corporations in this country, despite the fact that corporations are enjoying record-breaking profits, one out of four pays nothing in federal income taxes. We're losing about $100 billion a year because these very same corporations are parking their money in the Cayman Islands or Bermuda and other tax havens to avoid U.S. taxes. These are companies who, if they can make a nickel more by shutting down an American company, will move to China to do that. And they have shut down very profitable companies in America simply because they can make even more money abroad. These are companies where their CEOs come together through the business roundtable, come into Washington and tell us, oh, yeah, you guys are going to have to cut or raise the retirement age for Social Security or raise the age at which people will be eligible for Medicare, and you got to cut this and you got to cut that. All the while they're making unbelievable salaries, and they have all of these, you know, incredible pension plans for themselves. So I think, you know, Archie is quite right. We need to make it clear to corporate America that they cannot continue with their greedy ways. They've got to help us create jobs in this country, and when necessary, I think we've got to really do some antitrust work. We certainly have to break up the very large Wall Street financial institutions, which today have just incredible power.
You know, the last president to do that was Jimmy Carter. I think he finished the job with AT&T. Do you have any hope that any president in the future will start enforcing the Sherman Act again?
It needs to be done. Paul Krugman had a piece in the New York Times quoting Teddy Roosevelt,
right,
was one of the great, you know, trust busters, and
yeah,
a guy who ranted and worked against income and wealth inequality, and in fact passed the estate tax back in his day because he was concerned about the concentration of wealth in America. But those were the days when the Republican Party actually had people who were concerned about ordinary Americans.
Yeah, both Roosevelt and Taft, who followed him,
right,
busted up companies and raise tech. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, and Mike in Chicago listening on WCPT. You are on the air with Bernie.
Yes, Bernie, I think you had a great chance, I think, in the summer to extend unemployment benefits in that budget committee and raise taxes on corporations and possibly the wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, I guess, wouldn't it have been better to hash that out within that budget committee than dealing with an extreme right-wing House of Representatives to accomplish that?
The budget committee did pass a budget, which I helped work on, which was a fairly progressive budget. And what it did do is raise very substantial sums of revenue by ending corporate loopholes, and it also invested in rebuilding our infrastructure. That budget passed the Senate, as I recall, after I think we passed it in the middle of the night after hours and hours and hours of debates and amendments. We passed it by one vote, but we did pass it. But the House has a very different approach toward budget matters. The Republican House has been pretty strong about saying that, no, we're not going to ask large corporations to pay more in taxes. No, We're not going to ask the wealthiest individuals in this country to pay more in taxes. What we will do, and you saw that in terms of food stamps, is they proposed a $40 billion cut in food stamps over a 10-year period. They wanted to make massive cuts in Medicaid, transform Medicare. That is their agenda. They do not want to ask the wealthiest people in this country to pay a nickel more in taxes. So that's the essential problem that we have.
Okay. Steve in Perrysville, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I want to know how you get the Democratic Party to start talking about how these Republicans got all these crazy ideas and stuff, and get some backbone and, you know, tell the people about what's happening and stuff.
Well, Steve, thank you. I agree with you. You know, I think right now we are in a moment in history where there is massive disillusionment. And I fear very much that because of that disillusionment, the voter turnout in the 2014 elections are going to be very low. And if it is very low, the folks who will come out will be wealthier, older, white folks, who are going to elect a Republican Senate. And I think the antidote to that is just what Steve suggests, and that is that the Democrats have got to be very firm in what they stand for and what they stand against. And in fact, as I mentioned a moment ago, there is an agenda that I hope gets out to the people, that I hope engages the people, about a significant jobs program, about raising the minimum wage, about pay equity for women, about college affordability, about not giving tax breaks to companies who are shipping our jobs to China. But what you need are Democrats who are prepared to stand up to corporate America and Wall Street and the Koch brothers. And I would not be honest if I suggested to you that every Democrat is prepared to do that. Many of them simply are not. And that's something that we've got to change.
Nathan in Valley, Alabama. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Tom, thank you very much for the quality programming. I was saying with time, Senator Sanders, it's impossible for me to say to you how much I follow your career, and I'm suffice to say that I'm just honored to speak with you. But I wanted to ask you a question on one thing that you and I disagree about, and that is Democrats often advocate for jobs in teachers, firefighters, and police officers because they're jobs that are, you know, not easy to get, but, you know, easier to get, and they can elevate you into the middle class. But they also advocate for cutting the military, and I think that they're very similar. Like, I'm a soldier myself, and I just wonder why. I know you're not a Democrat, but you're an independent, but I wonder why, you know, we advocate so much for cutting the military, because that's a good living for someone like me.
Right. Okay, Nathan, thanks very much for the good question, and thanks for your service to our country. Everybody, I think, agrees that we need a strong military. But the military per se, Nathan, is not a jobs program. The function of the military is to defend the United States of America and work with our allies around the world in the fight against terrorism and other international threats. That's its function. We don't expand the military just to expand the military. So I think I start off by asking, how does it happen that the United States today is spending almost as much, not quite, but almost as much as the rest of the world combined on military matters? Do we need every single weapon system that is out there? Why is it that there is so much in terms of cost overruns on weapon systems? How does it happen that the Department of Defense can't even initiate an audit of the Pentagon because it is so complicated that they really don't even know where their money is going? So, Nathan, to answer your question, we need a strong military. I am especially a strong supporter of the National Guard program, the reserve program, which, A, defends us, but also provides for domestic needs in terms of floods and hurricanes and so forth. But I do not believe that we should just be spending money on the military for the sake of spending that money, even if it does create jobs. I would much rather create jobs in rebuilding our infrastructure in terms of teachers, in terms of creating sustainable energy and energy efficiency, social goals, which I think we should be striving for.
Well, and cuts to the military don't have to come at the expense of soldiers. We've got all these private contractors.
That is a very good point. What has happened in recent years is we have spent a huge amount of money in terms of private contractors, and I suspect that we could do a lot better by having people working for the U.S. military rather than these private contractors.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this break. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. The website itself is a great resource, a great news source. And there's also a newsletter that Bernie has, which is free, and you can sign up for it right there. It's called the Bernie Buzz.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll be back right after the news with more of your questions for Senator Sanders. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And, Senator, there you are. I see you. Okay. Bruce in Trenton, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Bernie.
Hey, Bruce.
Hey. I want to talk to you a bit, and hi, Tom, too. I want to talk to you guys a bit about an import tariff tax and how we could use that money to fuel a legislation that would have an earlier retirement so we can fill these jobs with some hungry young people.
And are you talking about a tariff?
Yeah, an import tax tariff.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, all these corporations that are making things in China, make them cost as much as it would if they were made right here in the U.S. and funnel that money into an earlier retirement program so we can open up a whole bunch of jobs for younger folks.
Well, I think you got a couple of issues there, Bruce. And, you know, Tom and I have talked about this many, many, many times. And here is, in my view, the bottom line. The bottom line is that the trade agreements that the United States has established in the last 20, 25 years have failed. And by that I mean NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China and other trade agreements. All of those trade agreements were pushed by corporate America with the goal of being able to shut down in this country. And in the last 13 or 14 years, we have lost over 50,000 factories in this country and millions of decent-paying jobs, not all attributable to trade, but a whole lot that are attributable to trade. Because when companies can move to China or Vietnam and pay people a buck an hour or 50 cents an hour, there is no great reason for them to want to stay in the United States of America. So what Bruce is talking about is doing what we have historically done, and that is establish tariffs to protect manufacturing. I do not know how the middle class grows in this country unless we start producing the products that we consume. And to do that, corporate America is going to have to reinvest in the United States of America and not in China, not in Vietnam, and not in Mexico. And tariffs are certainly one way to do that. So I got to tell you, Bruce, I have voted against every trade agreement that has come down the pike, and I think those were the right votes. And we've got to change in a very fundamental way our trade policy.
Taylor in San Jose, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi.
Hi, I'm in the Air National Guard, and I'm very big on military news. My question is, why was there such a lack of coverage for the veterans bill that got shot down by the...
That is a very good question, and I say that as chairman of the committee and the guy who wrote the bill. You know, my own view is that the media itself... the corporate media does not pay a whole lot of attention to issues impacting working people. And most veterans, in fact, are working people. They're much more interested in political gossip and who's going to run for president in 2098 and stuff like that. But here you have a bill, which I am quite familiar with because it came out of my committee, that would improve the lives of millions of our veterans, people who have put their lives on the line to defend our country, and not only improve the lives of veterans, but their families as well. I think Taylor is quite right. We got 56 votes. The Republicans brought forth what they call a budget point of order, which required 60 votes. We got 56. There was one Democrat who was not there who would have voted for it. That's 57. And we are working very, very hard to get the 3 votes, and I think we will, to pass what will be the most comprehensive veterans bill passed in a very, very long time. But I can't tell you much more than what Taylor said. It did not get a whole lot of coverage, and I think that just corporate media not worrying about what happens to ordinary Americans very much.
That's amazing. Was that shot down by the Republicans?
Of course. We got 56 votes, 54 of them. We had all of the Democrats, and we had 2 Republicans. One Democrat was absent. So 54 plus 2 is 56. We got one more is 57. And now we're working with a number of Republicans to get 3 more votes.
Because some Republican has filibustered this and set up the 60-vote barrier.
Right, a budget point of order which required 60 votes. You know, and what really gets me, you know, is on Veterans Day and Memorial Day, all of these guys go out, oh, we love the veterans, thank you so much, thank you families. And yet they had the opportunity to vote for a bill that was strongly endorsed by virtually every major veterans organization, the American Legion, the DAV, the VFW, the Vietnam vets, the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America, the Gold Star Wives, virtually all of the veterans organizations said, this will be really important to the veterans community. And these guys said, no, we don't want to vote for it. But we're working on it, and I think we eventually are going to get it passed.
Great. David, in Shelter Cove, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Thank you for your work, Senator Sanders.
Thank you.
I'm wondering with this latest Wells Fargo fraud, is anybody ever going to go to jail for bankers?
Well, David, that is a great question. I got to tell you, I am asked that almost every day. And it is, you know, you got to take a deep breath and stop and think about it. Here you have these guys in, you know, virtually every one of the major financial institutions in this country who are complicit in illegal behavior, which resulted in the terrible recession that we're trying to fight our way out of right now, resulted in millions of people losing their jobs, their homes, their life savings. And these guys are now reaching agreement with the United States government, in some cases, for $10 billion, not an insignificant sum of money. And yet none of these guys are going to jail. They're reaching agreements, they're paying penalties, but they are not being held accountable. And, you know, to my mind, that really raises in a very deep level the nature of our criminal justice system and whether or not the system is capable of really prosecuting these very, very wealthy and powerful people. So if you're a small-time criminal, no, we can go after you. If you break a window, you're a kid, we can go after you. But whether you are the head of a multi-billion dollar bank that has committed serious crimes, it remains to be seen whether we can go after you, whether or not you're just too powerful.
Ken in Great Falls, Montana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. We have an open Senate seat here, and we have a guy running for it on jobs. He's a Republican, Mr. Daines, and he started a company here in this state, and he's created over 400 jobs in the software industry. But then he did what all industries have done in the last 30 years. He sold out to Oracle, which now has over 60% of their jobs overseas. So now these jobs are you know, this whole idea is what these Republicans are doing, are sending these jobs overseas. And I wonder, is there any legislation that's trying to stop this?
Yes, there is. There is. And it's a very, if you look at, and I don't know Mr. Daines at all. I do know Senator Walsh, who is also running for that seat and hope that he will win. But if you look at virtually every major corporation in America, I think almost everyone, if not everyone, the number of American employees that they have today is significantly less than used to be the case. And the reason for that, whether it's, you know, General Electric or IBM or any of these companies, is they have transferred a great deal of their work to other countries. And this is a huge, huge issue. So Ken asked, is there legislation? And the answer is certainly there is. We talked a moment ago about the need to reestablish tariffs. Certainly we want to do away with these tax breaks. Companies literally get tax breaks for shutting down a company. It takes money to shut down a company, and they can write that off and get a tax break for that. So there is a lot that has to be done, but at the end of the day, the fundamental issue has to deal with trade and the global economy, how we demand that these companies reinvest in America and create the jobs in the manufacturing sector that we desperately need rather than send jobs. And it's not just blue-collar manufacturing jobs. It is white-collar information technology jobs to countries all over the world.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. This week, the Republicans bowed down to their sugar daddies, the Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers. And I don't include either of you in this category, but some so-called progressives have been saying the Democrats are just as bad as the Republicans, even though the Democrats are fighting for women's rights, raising the minimum wage, creating jobs, regulating and fining the big banks billions of dollars. The Republicans are blocking progress on all these things. If the Republicans are, or if the Democrats are just as bad as the Republicans, why are billionaires spending hundreds of millions of dollars to defeat them and elect Republicans? Do they like to waste money?
All right, Paul, that's a good question. And let me answer it this way. You're right. There have historically and maybe now people are saying, well, you know, both parties are equally bad. I disagree strongly with that. What you have now in the Republican Party in recent years is a party that used to be a kind of conservative moderate party being transformed to a right-wing extremist party. And these guys are coming up at the statewide level and in Washington with ideas, radical extremist ideas in terms of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, abolishing the concept of the minimum wage, eliminating the Environmental Protection Agency, more tax breaks for billionaires, coming up with ideas that 20 or 30 or 40 years ago Republicans never would have dreamed of. In fact, I remember, I think, Tom, you read Dwight D. Eisenhower's platform that he ran on for re-election.
That's right.
Pride in raising the minimum wage and doing things for workers.
Yes, increasing unionization.
So, you know, you can say, and I do say, that the Democratic Party is not anywhere near as strong as it should be in fighting the fights that have
You're
to be
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com.
But that is different than saying that both parties are the same.
Yeah, but that's different than... Okay, thank you. Senator Sanders, we'll be right back with more of Brunch with Bernie. And welcome back. Let's see here. Ed in Erie, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Senator Sanders, we've got Citizens United and ALEC out there, but we also have a bunch of career criminals. So what we need is grand juries to take these people, all their information, how much they give in campaign contributions, how much they pay in taxes, fines, et cetera, and so forth. You know, they're adjusted fines when they appeal it. And then we need to apply the RICO Act to these people that so they can't get out of paying those taxes just because they broke the law.
Well, Ed, I wish I thought it was that simple. It's not. What really goes on is these guys help make the laws, and then they take advantage of the laws that they make. So if you look at, Citizens United was a decision rendered by the United States Supreme Court. It's a 5-4 decision. To my mind, it is probably the worst decision made by the Supreme Court in a very, very long time. And that the result of that is that the very foundations of American democracy, one person, one vote, are being undermined by the huge flood of money coming into the political process from the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and other billionaires. It's a total disaster. Is it legal? Yeah, well, it is legal. What we have to do now, we're looking at IRS law to make sure that they are not taking advantage and of the law. But basically, you know, Citizens United became the law of the land. In terms of tax breaks, well, hey, you can stash your money so long as we don't have legislation to prevent it, and we have introduced legislation to prevent it. You can stash your billions of dollars in profits and put it in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and not pay taxes on it. You got 1 out of 4 corporations in America not paying any federal income taxes. So what we need to do, is change the law. We need to overturn Citizens United. We need to have public funding of elections. We need to do away with these incredible tax loopholes so that we bring more revenue into the government, so that we can create the kinds of jobs that we need, make sure that the most vulnerable people in this country have the kind of resources that they need, end the disgrace of the United States having the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. And what really bothers me is we are looking now at a nation in which we're seeing more and more millionaires and billionaires at exactly the same moment that the middle class disappears and more people fall into poverty. And that is not the kind of country that we want. It is not the kind of country that we need. And we've got to fight back against those people who are moving us in that direction.
Bernie, we just have 30 seconds. You want to add what people can do to make that happen?
Look, these are serious times, and we need some serious activity. People cannot sit on the sideline. You know, you have got to be involved in our democracy. You've got to work with those candidates who are prepared to stand up for working families. You've got to work with your friends and your relatives and raise the issues and help organize and educate. These are dangerous times in America. And unless we stand together, you're going to see people like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson having more and more and more power, and that will be a disaster for this country.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour will be back with more of your questions from Senator Sanders right after this. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting taking your questions. And Tony in New Lenox, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV on Roku. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, sir. It's a pleasure. I just want to ask Mr. Sanders if he plans on running for president, hopefully with Elizabeth Warren. And I have one other comment. I just want to say the only unions that we need to appear are the ones with the CEOs in them that sit on each other's board and dictate the wages that common people earn. Thank you very much, and you guys have a great weekend, okay?
Thank you,
Tom. Thanks very much, Tony. You know, what I have said, and let me just repeat it now, is I really do not wake up with a burning desire to become president of the United States. On the other hand, what I do wake up seeing is a nation which has more serious problems today than any time since the Great Depression. I wake up seeing a great middle class, what was once a great middle class, disappearing. And we need people, and I'm not suggesting I'm the only one who can do it, but we do need people to stand up for the working class of this country, the need to create jobs, the need to deal with this income and wealth inequality, the need to fight for health care for all people, the need to address the crisis of climate change and education and so forth. So, you know, I'm giving thought to it. It's very early in the process, Tony. We got a 2014 election, but I am giving some thought to it.
Howard in Hollywood, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I'd just like to ask, where is our Darrell Issa, Karl Rove, Frank Luntz, Grover Norquist? And I'm very, very disappointed that Al Franken is not one of our voices. I thought he'd be a big one. We don't have any spokespersons that are really out front.
I think you're talking to one right now, Howard, with Senator Sanders.
Oh, no question about it. But I'm asking, where are the equivalents of who get all the stage?
Well, Howard, I think the last part of your comments are maybe the most important, who get all the stage, and then you got to talk about who owns the stage. Let me just give you an example of this. Right now, in my view, the trade union movement has stronger leadership and better leadership than I have ever seen in my lifetime. Rich Trumka is head of the AFL-CIO. You have people like Leo Girard, head of the Steelworkers. You have Larry Cohn, head of the CWA. You have a bunch of great union leaders. You know what? You haven't seen them on Meet the Press too often. You haven't seen them on Face the Nation. You haven't seen them on the network news. I have done press conferences on a number of occasions with Rich Trumka, who's head of the AFL-CIO, represents millions and millions and millions of workers, virtually no media there at all. So to answer Howard's question, it's not that there are not, you know, certainly we need more. I won't argue that. Strong progressive voices. We certainly do need more. But those voices do not get the theater, the stage, that the right wing does. You know, you can, well, I can go on and on about that, but that is an important reality.
Yeah, they have a slogan, if it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press. My slogan is, if it's Sunday, it's Republicans on TV. Janice in Englewood, Colorado. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to AM 760.
Hello, both of you, and thank you both for all you do. My question is regarding an older relative who every year does their taxes and ends up owing money back to the government, and they want to know why their money doesn't go back into Social Security, why it goes into the general fund.
Well, we pay into the Social Security Trust Fund through the FICA tax, which is 6.2% from the employee and 6.2% from the employer. General taxes does not go into the Social Security Trust Fund. That's just FICA taxes that do that.
Okay. Jesse in Miami, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Sanders.
Yes.
Hey, I have an idea you couldn't lose if you ran for president. Well, it ain't my idea, but something to pass on to you. Hey, you talk about getting people motivated by the vote. The only other thing to motivate them is with the dollar. Everybody have a dollar. If you tell everybody to put the dollar in a public bank, a.k.a. like a Federal Reserve, and people will get motivated, say, okay, you put your money in this bank, you vote for me, I make sure you could pay for your house mortgage in 10 years instead of 30.
Are you talking about state banks like North Dakota has, Jesse?
Something like that, okay. But...
Senator?
I think it's a great idea. I'm a strong advocate of state banks. It's funny that what is now a conservative state in North Dakota has the only state bank in the country, started, I think, in the 1920s in the Progressive Movement. It has worked very well for them, and there's a lot of discussion in Vermont about that. So the issue here is whether you use your state resources, the taxes collected by state government, putting that money into a state bank, reinvesting that money in your own communities to generate wealth, rather than giving that money over to some Wall Street bank who will do something else with that money. So I am a strong, I think Jesse has a good point, and that is something that I think we should move forward on.
Great. We have just a few seconds, more than a minute left here in the hour. Senator, your thoughts for the coming week?
Well, let me first of all give an advertisement for myself. We have, as Tom mentioned, a great website, sanders.senate.gov. We also have now something like 400,000 people on Facebook, and I would urge listeners to get on our Facebook page. We are active every single day. We're disseminating a whole lot of good information. The bottom line, let me conclude the program today by saying that it is absolutely imperative that people get involved in the political process, because if you do not, I will guarantee you 100% the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and the other billionaires will be involved. And while you may not be a billionaire, while you may not be able to contribute hundreds of millions of dollars into politics, you can get your friends out to vote. You can demand and hold accountable your elected officials. So we have got to step up to the plate here and get as many people involved in the electoral process as we possibly can.
That's a giant tag, you're it. It is. Senator Sanders, thanks so much for that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Paul.
Great talking with you today. And so appreciate your being with us. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Back a year ago, we're going to do Anything Goes Friday, by the way, as soon as I finish this short riff and pick up your calls. But back a year ago, Oxfam International, just crunched some numbers that and made news at the Davos World Economic Forum by pointing out that the world's richest 85 people owned an amount of wealth equal to that of half the population of Earth. Half of all of humanity had wealth equal to that of the richest 85 people. It's been less than a year since that number came out, and Forbes, Casilla Moreno is reporting over at Forbes today that 85 people, equaling half of the wealth of the world, 85 people own half the wealth of the world, or an amount of wealth equal to the bottom half. That's now 67 people. That's pretty mind-boggling. And 28 of them are from the United States. No other country comes even close. Germany and Russia have the second highest number with 6 each. The super rich are coming from the U.S. By the way, I mentioned yesterday, and I never got an opportunity to get into it, you've probably seen those commercials where the former candidate for president and one-term senator, Fred Thompson, is out there saying, you should get a reverse mortgage. You can take money out of your home and until you die or something like that. Well, a really interesting piece that if you are considering this or you know anybody who is or has, you might want to read over at the New York Times by Jessica Silver Greenberg. Might even be worth getting her on, as a reporter or anybody who's working on this thing, is that there are actually protections at law for people who have these reverse mortgages, and the companies have to sell you back the house within, I think it is 90 days of the time that the person dies. Let's say the problem is for the heirs, it's for the children or the siblings of the person who has the reverse mortgage. They end up with the property through probate, and then they end up with the mortgage. So say you've got a house that's worth, $500,000 and half of that, $250,000, has been drained off through a reverse mortgage, has been paid back out to that person before they died, and the housing market collapses and the house is only now worth $200,000, but you owe $250,000 on it. Well, the law says that the heirs can come in and buy that house from the reverse mortgage company for 95% of its appraised value. So if it's only worth $200,000 now, you could come in and buy it for, what would that be, $190,000, I think. And so, which raises the question, if you owe $250,000 and you're buying it for $190,000, who's picking up that $60,000 loss? Turns out it's a fund that all these reverse mortgage companies have to pay into. There's an insurance for them for this. That was set up by the federal government. They pay into this fund. It's part of the money that gets taken out of the reverse mortgage. But here's the problem. These companies are not telling people about this. People don't know what their rights are. And so the companies, in many cases, are initiating foreclosure procedures days, weeks after the person dies, long before, and never giving the heirs an opportunity to buy the property back. And so the house that you grew up in when dad and mom die ends up on the auction block when, a lot of heirs would have liked to have kept that house and, you know, just turned whatever debt is in it into a normal mortgage. Go to their local bank and say, hey, you know, give me a mortgage on this. We'll pay it off. Or they would have liked to own it enough that they could sell it. But the reverse mortgage companies are getting really slick. So just a heads up. You know, the program and the system at its heart is not an unreasonable one, and there are protections built into it. The problem is you've got for-profit businesses doing this. And if a for-profit business thinks that they can make more money by screwing people and they thinks that they can get away with it and no one's going to go to jail and the worst thing that will happen is they may pay a small fine, they will do that. And they are doing that, as Bernie, as Senator Sanders pointed out. You know, these banksters, if you walked up to somebody in a 7-Eleven and pulled a wallet out of their back pocket and ran off with a couple $100 in their credit cards, you could end up in prison for 2, 3, 5, 10 years, depending on the state that it happens in. But if you take their home, I mean, literally steal their home from them, throw them out on the street, and you don't just do it to one person, you do it to thousands or tens of thousands of people, you get a $10 million bonus if you're the CEO of one of these big banks. And you never go to jail. And if the government comes along and says, hey, you did wrong by those people, you don't have to make them whole. And the government doesn't make them whole. You just pay a fine and it goes into the general treasury. This is a sick and twisted way to run a country. There's something just at its core fundamentally wrong with this. So anyhow, enough of me. Eileen, you got something you want to pitch about the environment? By the way, from Big Sky, Montana.
Yes, I am. And yes, I have the Light Years Best Environmental Education and Agenda the World Needs that everyone that you think is working on behalf of the environment is preventing since 1994. I will end global environmental illiteracy with the education that James Hansen says no one is teaching, but I am. I just somehow need my global break over 20 years later. I will end our disposable society, which is our biggest abuse, which is when it got implemented is when all of our environmental problems started.
So how are you going to do this, Eileen?
I need the cooperation of some people. It'd be great. I mean, you know, Bill McKibben's on your site and he, you know, on your book review. And I mean, will 350 help? Absolutely not. First of all, it's very easy to get people to not use disposable products. You just have to educate them why they shouldn't.
Right. So is the essence of your call that you are complaining that these organizations will not sponsor you or promote you or your ideas?
No. I have the agenda the world needs, and it would be great if just to get this out there.
Do you have a website for this, Eileen?
Pardon me?
I will give you an opportunity to promote yourself to millions of people. Is there a website you'd like to plug?
Environmentaleducator.org is the it's the education. It's an app, too. It's a topic a week. Hopefully pretty soon I'm going to start becoming my own news distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a book. It's called Stop.
Hello?
It sounded like it went dead.
No, it didn't.
I have a book. It's called Stop Terrorism, United States Style. Greenhouse gases are weapons of mass destruction, too. And, you know, it lays out the agenda the world needs. I mean, ending our disposable society is very easy, from homes to fast food to stadium concessions to, you know, packaging and transportation packaging. We're going to have to brainstorm some of that.
Well, I love your passion, Eileen, and I wish you the very best. And I just did my best to give you a platform to get that out. So I hope it helps in some small way. Good luck. Thank you for the call. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Spaceships? Atheism? Paul Ryan? Any crazy thing you want to talk about? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri. Hey, Victor, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Well, it's good to hear from you, Tom. Well, I have you on instead of raising the issue about Ukraine, which I think is totally, I don't know what's wrong with our president. He should never go down that road. He should be for Russia as far as that, as far as if you just study history.
Well, I heard an interesting analysis of this last night. I had Michael Hudson, the world-famous economist, was on our TV show. And I said, you know, what's going on with this IMF loan to Ukraine? Because they've cobbled together $14 to $18 billion that they're going to give Ukraine. And then the U.S. government is giving them $1 billion. And he said, or he suggested, that the president is basically doing a sleight of hand. That, you know, there's all this nationalist sentiment here in the United States, and you got John McCain going over to Ukraine and all these other American politicians. And, you know, which when you think about it for a minute, is pretty bizarre. If Mexico is in turmoil and a bunch of members of the Russian upper house, the Russian equivalent of the Senate, were to go to Mexico and start giving speeches, I mean, you'd really be scratching your head. But in any case, what Michael Hudson suggested was that President Obama knows that he needs Russia. He not only needs Russia, but he's cooperating with Russia on Syria and on Iran right now, and on reducing the nuclear weapons and nuclear stockpiles and nuclear waste around the world. And so really what's happening here is that Ukraine owes $35 billion. Most of it they owe to Russia. So the president is organizing a campaign to give money to Ukraine so that Ukraine can pay off Russia. And, you know, it's like it's all going to turn out fine, thank you very much, except for the people of Ukraine, because the IMF is going to have austerity attached to it. So, you know, a year from now, Ukraine is going to be like Greece. But this is not going to hurt Russia, and it's not going to hurt the United States. I thought that was a really interesting analysis. I'm not sure where to go with it, but your thoughts?
Well, I don't know. I just have this fear about this rise of Nazism coming.
It's happening all over Europe.
Actually, throughout the world. I think even here.
Yeah.
And I was in Berlin. I served in HAC Berlin Brigade. Mm. So I've seen the wall. I've seen the East and the West.
Yep. Me too. I wasn't in the military, but I've been in East. I was in East Berlin when it was East Berlin and in West Berlin. Yeah.
Yeah. So you seen where the tank is at, you know, where it's and most people don't know this for history's sake. It was a woman tank driver that entered Berlin, the very first ally to enter Berlin.
Wow.
World War II.
Wow.
That's what. That's history for you.
Yeah.
And 20 million Russians died. So they have a reason for the fear about Nazism.
Yes, they do. And they have a reason to have a concern about hostile states or the potentially hostile states on their western border. Victor, thank you very much for the call. We'll see how it all plays out. This is pretty much all we can do. We'll see how it all plays. We'll be right back. Okay, what am I missing about Pascal? A Pascal is a unit. Pascal, what is it? What is it a unit of? Do you know? So maybe somebody can tell me. This is a joke. That Einstein, Newton, and Pascal are playing hide-and-seek. It's Einstein's turn to count, so he covers his eyes and starts counting to 10. Pascal runs off and hides. Newton draws a 1 meter by 1 meter square on the ground in front of Einstein, then stands in the middle of it. Einstein reaches 10 and uncovers his eyes. He sees Newton immediately and claims, "Newton, I found you! You're it!" And Newton smiles and says, you didn't find me. You found a Newton over a square meter. You found Pascal. Uh-huh. So it's a unit of pressure. Oh, so, okay. All right. Some jokes for smart people I don't get. What could I say? Brent in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hey, Brent, how you doing?
Good, Tom.
How's that oil spill, by the way, in the Kalamazoo River doing?
They're still working on it, believe it or not. It's
amazing.
Still breaking out.
They're still trying to clean it. It's because it's that tar sands oil. It's so hard to get out.
I'm not sure if that was the tar sands there. I know the BP in Whiting was. So.
Uh-huh. Okay. Anyhow, that's not what you called about. What's up?
Hey, just I was listening to Bernie earlier, and world economy. You know, he's talking about free trade. Why wouldn't we eliminate free trade? And I mean, there's probably a good answer, and I don't know this, but if a company in America wanted to sell a product over in a different country, and that country vice versa wants to sell here, go over there, buy a piece of property at the going rate in that area, pay their workers the scale that it should be paid for there with the benefits, and use the workers to build stuff there from that country, and then sell that product in their country for what it's worth there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because things would be different. And I know you can't do it with everything. You know, there's agriculture and materials would fall into the place for prices online and everything like that. But, I mean, what's your feelings on something like that?
There are two, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're suggesting that our companies, when they go overseas, should be engaged in production for overseas domestic markets. Is that what you're saying?
Yep, and vice versa.
Yeah, okay. Here's my problem with it. And this is why, basically, before the Reagan era, you pretty much didn't see this happening. When Toyota, for example, comes to the United States, builds a factory and makes Toyota cars for the U.S. car market, where does the profit from the manufacturer of those cars go?
Okay,
goes back to Japan, right?
Overseas.
Yeah, goes back to Japan. So it's a form of economic imperialism. I mean, this is what we used to do. I mean, we United Sugar, Dole, you know, the agricultural companies that did products, bananas, fruit, pineapple, sugar, that, you know, made products in tropical environments were some of the very worst abusers of this back in the era of my grandfather and father. It's economic imperialism where we would, you know, our companies would go into countries, they would buy up land really, really cheap. They would, you know, work people to death in very, very tough conditions. But, hey, it's a job. And then they'd bring all the money back to the United States. And it did not earn us friends around the world. I think that every country should become as independent and self-sufficient as possible. And I think, you know, I've talked about this before as a kind of economic semi-permeable barrier. Only marginally permeable barrier. And the way that you do this is with tariffs. And the international world order operated based on tariffs from really the 10th or 12th century up until about 30 years ago. And the consequence of that was that every country was relatively independent. They manufactured goods for their own market, and the companies that made those goods were owned by people, stockholders, and business owners within that country. And so money was continuously cycling within the economies of those countries. Now we have this very, very out of balance situation where giant corporations can roam the world looking for the cheapest labor, the lowest environmental regulations, and still make use of marketplaces like in the United States and Western Europe where labor is and the environment are fairly, you know, well regulated and well paid. And the consequence of that is not a particularly good one for anybody except these giant national corporations and the oligarchs that they spawn. And so that's why I'm opposed to this whole, you know, libertarian free trade, the world should have no boundaries notion. I think it undermines sovereignty, it undermines national independence, and history shows that it doesn't work. So anyhow, Brent, thanks for the call. It's a good one. Susan in Wauna, Washington. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Couple points. I'll try to be brief. Elizabeth Warren and Al Franken were trying to, because I am a C-SPAN junkie, trying to get what was called the Direct Relief Act back on the books, because as of December 31st, 2013, the former referendum had been depleted. What it actually has to do with is if your house is going to be foreclosed on, say its value is $160,000, you, as a former person living in that house, again, the gangster bangsters make away with the greed, will owe that value because that was an enrichment that you were able to enjoy. So you will have taxes assessed at that $160,000 income. The other point I wanted to make is, who is Tom Steyer? Does that name sound familiar?
Yeah, isn't he one of the politically... No, actually, I'm not sure. I'm not
for the Democrats, basically, because that's what is coming down as mucky poo for Senator Harry Reid. And I was just kind of curious because you know all if you knew that was.
I recognize the name, but I'm not sure why. And what immediately came to mind may well have been wrong, and so I'm not going to say it. I'll have to look it up. Susan, thanks for the call. Let me see what I can find out. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. It's Anything Goes Friday. Back with more of your calls and jokes for intellectuals right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, and Nate Silver says the Senate's going Republican. Harry Reid says he's wrong. I put my money on Harry Reid. So the hashtag cancel Colbert is blowing out in the Twitterverse. This is so bizarre. Stephen Colbert has to be laughing all the way to the bank. And in fact, there are some people who are speculating that maybe he set this thing up. Who knows? But taking a joke out of context and then getting huffy indignant about it, like Michelle Malkin did, is just weird. It's almost as weird as the governor of a state who's, you know, hiring with $1 million of the state's own money, hiring a law firm that is also defending the governor of the state, or maybe defending the governor of the state if he gets criminally prosecuted, hiring a law firm to say that the governor... It's all good. He didn't know anything was going on. And when he was told that something was going on, he forgot. Or he didn't hear it. Or he had his fingers in his ears and was yelling, liar, 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 all the time that the guy was telling him, David Wilson. You see this thing by Chris Christie? And the most offensive part of it is that basically this entire report, it's all about slut shaming. It's all about saying that Bridget Ann Kelly was... She was the center of evil. She was the bad one, and she was doing it because her relationship with Bill Stepien, Christie's campaign manager, had gone south. That Stepien had dumped her. She was a woman scorned. Now, Stepien has come out. His lawyers have come out and said this is outrageous. These people were consenting adults. They were both single at the time. And what does this have to do with anything? I'll tell you, it's slut shaming. It's blame the woman. I mean, they did everything but say it was that time of the month for her. It's obscene. I mean, it's obscene in the way that Ken Starr's indictment of Bill Clinton was so twisted and obscene. You know, that was actually pornographic. And there were parts of that you couldn't read on the radio. But this is. This is culturally pornographic. And it's Chris Christie setting up, Bridget Ann Kelly to take the fall and slut-shaming her, diminishing her credibility in advance of her defending herself. So we'll see where this goes. Chris Christie, though, yesterday was, out in Nevada, kissing the hand of Shelley Adelson, oh, great gambling mogul, please give me some money. Right. Anyhow, John, and back to Anything Goes Friday. John in Jeffersonville, Ohio. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, how are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better, John. How about you?
Good. Hey, I've been podcasting you for many years, and I kind of feel guilty because I've won a lot of arguments based on knowledge I've gotten from your show.
Oh, good. Well, then I'm doing my job.
Right, right. And I appreciate the fact that you go with the facts. Not, I fact-checked you a lot, and you're never wrong. I mean, honest to God, you're not. I do have a couple of things, though, that I'd like to – that I do disagree with you on because I agree with you about 99% of the time. And I don't want to hear the circular firing squad because I heard that once before from you, and I'd like to get my point across before you say that to me.
Okay.
I drive a truck and I do everything I can to work within the system. I call I've shared Brown at the center. He's a great guy, and I call Rob Portman. I call my congressman. I call the president. I do what I can. But here's the thing. Here's the one thing that I disagree with you on, and it's not because we don't want to go to the same place. It's how we get there, right? If Rahm Emanuel called the liberal, you know, the progressive, and I'm not going to use the curse word, but he said effing retard.
Yes.
Remember, correct?
I remember. Okay.
And you the other day said something about the Progressive Party is not driving the Democratic Party, and that's where I find the problem. In other words, power is not asserted. It's not power, okay? We need to push these guys and push them in the right direction. I'll just give you an example of what you do. And I don't know if you're aware of this, that you're doing it, but you often say Reagan stopped enforcing the Antitrust Act, right?
And every president since him has refused to start.
But can Obama do so too?
He could, but he won't.
Right, I know that, but that's something I wish you would say. And there's every time.
Well, I think it's implicit. I'm pleased to say it. I just did say it. I'm not an apologist for any politician. I'm
right. But would you agree that we need to push them and kick them in the shins? And even if we lost an election, sometimes it's better to lose the election to take the party back and have control of the Democratic Party for the progressive base. Otherwise, we're just laying down to the corporatist part of the Democratic Party. You understand what I'm saying?
I do, and I don't disagree. I am strong, and in fact, let me take it a step beyond that. I'm strongly of the opinion that the Democratic Party losing some of their conservadems is probably a good thing, even if it means that Republicans end up with those seats, because the conservadems have been destroying the Democratic Party. It's a corrosive cancer inside the Democratic Party. We need to be out there working for progressive and populist candidates. I've told this story 1,000 times on the air. When we lived in, you know, Louise and I lived in Vermont for a decade, and every 2 years, Bernie was in the House of Representatives, so he ran for re-election every 2 years. And through the election of 2000 and through the election of 2004, I lived in Vermont, and we would drive all over the state, and you would see houses, particularly up in the Northeast Kingdom, the very, very rural, very poor, very conservative, very Republican part of Vermont, you would see houses with two signs out in the front yard, a red sign that said Bush for president and a blue sign that said Bernie for Congress. And because Bernie Sanders tells the truth, we need more Democrats who behave the way that Bernie Sanders does, even though he's not a Democrat, but he caucuses with them. But there are Democrats like, you know, who are like Bernie Sanders. You got Sherrod Brown out there. You've got Keith Ellison. Thank you. You've got Peter DeFazio. You've got Elizabeth Warren. I mean, there are some very good, and there's a whole bunch of Jan Schakowsky. I mean, there's a whole bunch of really good progressive Democrats, and they have the Progressive Caucus. They came up with a budget. The problem isn't that they're not asserting their power. They're doing everything they can, and they're doing everything right as far as I can tell. And they are engaging with organizations like Progressive Democrats of America and others to help get their message out. Problem is NBC, ABC, CBS will not put them on the air. You know, when Paul Ryan comes out with a wackadoodle budget, right-wing crazy budget that has no chance of making it through the House of Representatives or through the Senate, and no chance of getting a presidential signature. They don't say, oh, this has no chance of succeeding. They say, oh, look at Paul Ryan did something amazing. Let's, you know, and he's all over the media. The Progressive Caucus, which is actually larger than the Tea Party Caucus, comes out with a budget that is a balanced budget that grows the economy, that puts America back to work. And yes, it has no chance in hell of making it through the House of Representatives. It might make it through the Senate, but it doesn't have a chance of making it through the House of Representatives. And so it's equally dead on arrival as Paul Ryan's. But does the media say, well, we gave a lot of coverage to Paul Ryan on the right. Why don't we give a lot of coverage? Why don't we get Raul Grijalva on, you know, from the Progressive Caucus and talk about his budget? No, they don't. Why? Because most of the media is big corporations, and big corporations benefit from budgets that Republicans put together, and they don't benefit from budgets that progressives put together. The progressive budget raises the income tax on the multimillionaires and billionaires who own or run the large media institutions. So we've got structural and systemic problems in this country that have to do with the aggregation of power, political power and media power, which is the consequence of the aggregation of wealth. And we've got to face that, and we've got to do something about that. And that, I think, is going to take a student, not a student movement. We've got to deal with the student loan debt problem as well. But that's going to take a movement. MoveToAmend.org has over 300,000 people have signed up. They've gotten over 500 communities that have, you know, signed on to their constitutional amendment to say money is not speech and corporations aren't persons. That's the cancer that's at the core of all this, and that's what we need to be attacking. Am I making sense, John, and have I answered your question?
You're making perfectly good sense, and I agree with where we want to go. It's just sometimes I get so frustrated because it's like, gosh, the answers are so simple. There's no problem in this country we couldn't solve if we had the political will. Honest to God, there's not.
You're right.
Within 5 years.
You're right. And that's the core premise of my book, The Crash of 2016, is it's going to take a crash to get people PO'd enough and upset enough that they're actually going to take a look at the history of what's happened. And I lay it out in the book and do something and, you know, get politically active. It happened in the 30s. I think it's going to happen when the next crash happens. And I think actually it happened when the last crash happened. And President Obama came in 2009 with enormous political capital as a consequence of the crash that had just happened. And I think that in some ways he blew it. He missed some opportunities that were there. On the other hand, you know, he did accomplish a lot, and it's damn hard to second guess the president. So, but anyway, we'll see. I still think that there's an opportunity for progressive.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, if you want an interesting exercise, it's in my book, Threshold, but just Google New Covenant Speech, the campaign that Bill Clinton campaigned on, didn't govern on. Welcome back. Rick in Osceola, Iowa. Hey, Rick, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I've been seeing on TV about that disaster out in Washington and how that big mudslide is just inundated this whole town.
Right.
And I don't see our National Guard there. Isn't that? I've always thought the National Guard was for disasters and there to be helping us. And, you know, we just had a small tornado just outside of town here yesterday, and it wiped out 3 or 4 farm buildings, and it could have been the whole town.
And the National Guard wasn't there either?
Well, they don't come to something like that, you know. Yeah. We can kind of all clean that up. But
yeah, I don't know if the National Guard is okay. Shano just did a quick news search, and the National Guard is in Washington State helping dig people out from now. It's digging bodies out, tragically, out from underneath that. It was a whole side of a hill that just came down.
Oh, it was terrible. Well, I just didn't see them. Well, you know, I see the video and everything. And then another thing I want to bring up to you is, you know, our Congressman Bruce Brierley here in Iowa, he's campaigning for Tom Harkin's seat. You know, Tom's going to retire.
Right.
Well, he was down in Texas, you know, they got a campaign so hard outside of out of the state to try to raise all this money and everything. Well, he's down in Texas talking to the trial lawyers union, and they record him like they did Romney. at least talk. And, well, he said some things that were complimentary to Grassley. Well, now he's in they're making him look like, well, he ain't really for us here in Iowa. He's out here campaigning to these Texans when, you know, I think Brierley needs to come out and say, you know, I've got to travel everywhere to find the money.
Right. That's the problem, is that, you know, politicians, on the one hand, they know that because of these Supreme Court decisions dating back to arguably to Buckley and before to 1977, that 76, I think Buckley was, that because of these Supreme Court decisions, they have to raise mind-boggling amounts of money. Every member of Congress has to spend roughly 60% of every day dialing for dollars, asking for money. They know that. But on the other hand, if they say it out loud, it causes people to think, oh, you're one of them. You're one of those guys who's just always going to got his hand out. And it's because the average citizen doesn't realize, because, once again, our media doesn't report it. Our media doesn't talk about, you know, who's funding the politicians, unless the funders go out and strut around, you know, like Shelley Adelson does.
They've got a commercial out already, you know, against Brierley of what he did when they, you know, most people, I don't think, realize that, you know, this, what is it, Citizens United thing has just ruined our government.
Yeah, it's ruined our political system. It's our system of governance. This Supreme Court, the Roberts Court, and frankly the Rehnquist Court before it, have done so much damage to our democracy. They have done so much to help create an oligarchy in this country, and you take that plus Reaganomics, and the whole spectrum of Reaganomics, from the tax cuts to the ending the Sherman Act, or not enforcing the Sherman Act, to doing away with the Fairness Doctrine, on and on and on, all these things. And what you get out of it is, you know, it's Chicago School economics. I mean, it's like we're one of the failed Soviet states, former Soviet states. We're becoming Estonia or Latvia, and, you know, which is not to knock those countries. I was in those countries. I was in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania right after the wall fell. But it's like, boy, it's a tough way to live. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. I'm trying to remember the cities that Louise and I visited right after the wall fell. We were going up the Baltic states, and we went from Warsaw, Poland, to Vilnius in Lithuania, to Riga in Latvia, to Tallinn in Estonia, if I'm remembering correctly. Victoria Jones would know. Victoria Jones, reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Victoria, how you doing?
I'm great, thanks, Tom. Yourself?
I am fine, thank you. What's going on in the world today?
President Obama met today with King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in what's being described as an effort to reaffirm the importance of the relationship with the nation amid disagreements on Syria and Iran. White House National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes told reporters that their two-hour meeting provided the leaders an opportunity to talk about the differences on Syria and Iran, as well as issues pertaining to Middle East peace and other regional developments. Although the main focal point would center on Syria, President Obama wasn't expected to make any announcement about additional assistance to the nation. The Saudis would like us to provide shoulder-launched missiles for the Syrian opposition, and the U.S. and the Jordanians oppose that because they're concerned that these man pads could fall into the hands of Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-linked jihadist groups within Syria.
Well, it's not just that they could fall into their hands, it's that some of the opposition is Al-Qaeda.
That's correct.
And it's so ironic because, you know, Al-Qaeda is a Sunni Muslim group that kind of grew out of, well, we helped create it, but it grew out of Saudi Arabia, you know, arguably, and the Saudis are just fine with that, it seems. I'm wildly overgeneralizing. Anyway, back
right.
to you.
The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, this week is saying that it's not ready to embrace mandatory labeling regulations for foods made with genetically engineered ingredients. This despite an aggressive push from lawmakers and advocates who cite health concerns. FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg told lawmakers this week, "We have not seen evidence of safety risks associated with genetically modified foods," she said to the House Appropriations Committee. Representative Nita Lowey from New York criticized that. She said, "It's beyond me that we can't have accurate labeling," she said to Hamburg. "The labeling can't hurt anybody, but it's possible that the lack of adequate labeling could, of course."
So the argument here was not about whether or not there should be GMOs in our food supply, but whether or not we should know what is a GMO?
Right, because GMOs are apparently present in as much as 80% of the nation's food already.
So we're a giant experiment in process.
We are already an experiment in process. It's a question of giving the consumer an opportunity to know whether they wish to be part of the experiment.
Right, right. Remarkable.
Yes, indeed.
And the FDA's position, the administration's position, is let the experiment proceed.
Is let the experiment proceed. Now, some states are saying that they would like to have mandatory labels. There is a move by the food industry to have voluntary labeling and to have a law for voluntary labeling, but that law would preempt any states from having mandatory labeling.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
But there was a victory on the other side today. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled today, and it tossed out an industry bid for an injunction blocking a rule on country of origin labeling on cuts of meat sold in the United States. Now, there is a rule saying that meat in the sold in the United States has to say that it was born in Mexico, raised in Canada, and slaughtered in the United States. And the meat industry doesn't want it to say that. They don't want it to say that at all. But there's a problem because the World Trade Organization ruled in 2012 that you've got to say that because if you don't, it's unfair to all the countries involved. So they went to court and said that this is against the First Amendment and it's going to be costly and it doesn't further a government interest. Well, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals today said, obviously, ruled against them and said, obviously, it enables a consumer to apply patriotic or protectionist criteria in the choice of meat. And it enables one who believes that United States practices and regulations are better at assuring food safety than those of other countries, or indeed the reverse, to act on that premise.
Hmm.
So what they're saying is that, yeah, you have to label your meat. People have a right to know where their meat comes from.
Now, that's more country of origin than GMO.
Right. That is country of origin. It's not GMO. But
it's a step in that direction. The consumer.
Inform the consumer is what the D.C. Court of Appeals said.
Interesting.
The Justice Department said today that it will recognize same-sex marriages that were performed in Michigan last weekend, basically in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, it was like 323 of them, I think.
Right, I think so. Despite the couples now being in legal limbo. As you know, a district court judge last Friday said struck down the 2004 ban on same-sex marriage. People rushed out, got marriage licenses, got married. Next day, federal appeals court said, no, we're putting a stop to this while the appeals process goes through. Governor Rick Snyder said that Michigan will not grant the newly married couple state rights and benefits because the legal proceedings are now pending. But Eric Holder, the attorney general, said these families will be eligible for all relevant federal benefits on the same terms as other same-sex marriages.
That's very good of him. It's really kind of, Rick Snyder, I mean, is he going to take a hit for this politically?
I'm not sure, because the ban passed overwhelmingly in the state of Michigan. I'm not sure that he will take a hit for this.
Yeah. That's a sad commentary on my home state. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
As always, great seeing you, great talking. We'll be right back. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. What's on your mind?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And, a tweet from SecGally Helper. Is Senator Sanders already done? Yeah. Sorry about that. Anyway. And in our chat room, Anatole78 says, I had to ask in my biology class, if GMOs are so essential, why are the food industrialists spending so much money to block labeling GMOs? That's a good question. Oh, and Don Knotts, you know, yeah, he played in Three's Company, but he was in Mayberry RFD. I mean, you know, come on. It's okay. You don't know what I'm talking about. You haven't been in the chat room. So back to the phone lines. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Anything Goes Friday. And since you just mentioned those two words, spaceships, I got one question for you. Once we humans get the chance to start a food chain on another planet, we're going to do it. Who's to say intelligent beings didn't come here, start a food chain, and we are the net result of that?
I'm not disagreeing with you. I think it's unlikely because there's a fairly clear and visible evolutionary path from, you know, paramecium and amoeba and single-celled plants in the ocean 2 billion years ago to us. But it's not impossible that you know, some variations on the life on this planet have had extraterrestrial origin.
I agree. And just one last question. I'll hang up. Well,
I think it's more likely, if I may say, I think it's more likely that we have been visited and not modified. And, you know, I still find Eric von Däniken's stuff fascinating. I know that he's supposedly officially been debunked, but, you know, the Chariots of the Gods stuff. But I think that I was down in Mexico a couple of weeks ago for a vacation, and you look at some of these rock paintings and go, wow, that looks like a guy on a spaceship. Anyhow, back to you, Michael.
Well, yeah, just one last thing. You sort of stole my thunder there. Maybe they just stepped in. Again, we don't know how long these people have been around. If the universe has been here for 14 billion years, we don't know how long these, if they exist, these people have been around. Let's just say they just don't visit us every once in a while and tweak the little situation, making us so different from every other animal.
Could be. Or it could be that they just visit us to say, you know, what's going on there? Has that planet reached the point where it's worth communicating with them? Do they have themselves under control? You know, is this a civilization that we'd like to hang out with? So far, apparently, the answer's been no.
Gotcha. No. All right. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Good to hear from you. Preston in Midland City, Alabama. Hey, Preston, what's up? Preston, you are on the air. Preston, I can't hear you. Give us a call back. And Charles in Hamilton, Texas. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk to you about the case of Dodge versus the Ford Motor Company.
back in the 1920s in Michigan, Michigan Supreme Court?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're familiar with that?
Oh, I'm very familiar with it. That's the case that's always cited when people say that the law requires corporations to make every decision in the context of maximizing profits. That was the argument that Horace Dodge made, or the Dodge brothers actually made, against Henry Ford.
Yeah, really what Ford was trying to do was he wanted to use profits of the company to start programs in the community to help the working poor. And Dodge sued on the behalf of the shareholders, saying that by law all the profits had to go to the shareholders. And the
I don't know about the community programs. I mean, Henry Ford was a racist and an anti-Semite who published a newspaper in Dearborn. I used to live in that neck of the woods. Louise and I lived in Westland, which is a Detroit suburb right next door to Dearborn, back when she was pregnant with our first child. I had a job as an engineer at RCA for a while to get health insurance. And I've read some of Henry Ford's newspapers, and he just constantly was going off on Jews and black people. But he did, his partner, whose name was something like Preston. I'd have to look it up. But his business partner and financier was a guy who was a very, very progressive. He ended up being a state senator in Michigan. And Henry Ford's wife was quite progressive. And they basically harassed him into raising the pay of his workers from $1 a day to $5 a day. And then when he did that, of course, it started accruing a lot of benefits to him and to the Ford Motor Company. Particularly, he got the best workers, you know, really good, because back then there was a lot of handwork that went into a car, and even though there was an assembly line, there was still an awful lot of handwork, and the best tool and die makers and the best, you know, precision people were leaving the Dodge company and going to work for Henry Ford. And so Horace and his brother, I forget his brother's name, sued Henry, saying that he was paying too much wages. I believe that that's the essence of the case. It's been at least 20 years since I read the case, but I'm pretty sure that I have it right.
Yeah, but the upshot is that a lot of people have used this case to argue that corporations have to optimize their operations in order to maximize profits for the shareholders.
Correct.
But that's not really what it said. It just said that whatever profits they make have to go to the shareholders. But anyway, my question is this. This is a ruling by the Michigan State Supreme Court.
Right.
This issue of how corporations are operated,
right,
is that something that can be determined at the federal level, or does it have to be determined state by state?
It pretty much has to be determined state by state, and the reason why is because the word corporation does not exist in our Constitution. Now, if the Supreme Court takes another few steps towards making corporations persons, then, you know, you could logically argue, I suppose, that corporations nationwide are persons and are subject to a far more exhaustive federal overview than they have right now. But for the moment, you can only incorporate a corporation federally through an act of Congress, whereas to incorporate a corporation in a state, all you have to do is file the appropriate papers with the Secretary of State's office and get the approval of the Secretary of State, which is typically not withheld.
So if we go through with this movement to amend the Constitution,
right,
saying that corporations are not people.
Correct.
And that money is not speech.
Right.
Could we also amend it to say how corporations are operated or created, or how they, work?
I think it would be... It would unnecessarily complicate the matter, because here's what happens. There are people who also say, hey, you know, if we're going to pass a Supreme Court or a constitutional amendment that says corporations aren't protected by the 14th Amendment and money is not protected by the First Amendment, why don't we add to that there's a cap of $100,000 that can be used in a political campaign or something like that? And my response to that is that those things will come as a consequence of doing away with corporate personhood and the primacy of money. When money has become something that can be regulated in the political sphere, and when corporations are disempowered from competing with humans, then you will have politicians able to say to their corporate overlords, which they can't do right now, able to say to them, not only am I not going to take your money anymore, but I'm going to pass a law that says that you can't give money to me or my opponents, and that we no longer have to come on bended knee to you, Shelley Adelson, Koch brothers, whoever, because, you know, we're going to bring back McCain-Feingold, and we're going to even put more teeth in it. McCain-Feingold, which got knocked down by the U.S. Supreme Court in Citizens United. So all those good benefits, Charles, that you're trying to identify, all those will come as a logical consequence, some at the state level, some at the federal level, of our saying no to the Supreme Court on corporate personhood and money as speech. Thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. This is why it's really simple. This is why the movetoamend.org constitutional amendment is the one, period. A Roman walks into a bar, holds up two fingers, and says, five beers, please. Okay. Oh, man. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've known you for a really long time.
Yeah, 9 years, I think, maybe 10.
Right. And outside of not personally knowing you and hanging out with you for a couple of days, boy, would I really love to do that, to get into your mind. But
why do you do every day? I mean, so
well, okay, this is the way it really is.
Just for the record, Armin, I don't have a persona that I put on when I go on the radio. And the people who work here, Shane is nodding his head right now. What you see is what you get. I am me, opinionated and everything else, off the air the same way I am on the air. I think that's probably true of everybody in radio. I know for a fact it's not true in television. On television, you can pretend to be somebody that you're not, but I don't think you can fake it 3 hours a day, particularly in talk radio when you're interacting with people. You just have to be who you are.
Well, then I'm going to ask you and ask, let the world hear my question, and Okay. Please give me just a few more moments. You can cut me off like you do whenever you want. You're the boss. It's your show. But I want to put some things at ease. So then what I constitute in my perception and the great length that I've observed your methodology the best that I can without personally knowing you before I heard you first on the radio and exclusively on the radio to the degree that I have throughout the 10 years. The question would be, and please let me have some follow up. I ask myself that we have philosophical disagreements. I think that's apparent that you know me pretty well, too, by listening to me and some of my points and claims and such. But, you know, respectfully, we have some philosophical disagreements. So I have to ask myself, of course, I believe, like most people do, that my avenue and path and philosophical application and combination of political choices, you know, to the right, to the left. You know, I'm not neither one.
Just FYI, Armin, Shane just gave me a 1 minute to the break cue.
Well, you know, my thing is this is strategy of your ultimate game plan and accomplishment that you hope to realize, or is this a flawed philosophy of you? And what I mean by this is case in point, and the clock's ticking. Okay, 45 seconds. Okay, if you tell everybody they're going to get $40,000, they don't have to work. The question is, who's going to work? The dollar.
People who love their work.
More worthless. Let me get my points out. The dollar will be worthless. Milk will be $20 a gallon. Gas will be $20 a gallon. And you know who's going to do the work and who's going to pay, because there's no free lunch.
So you're opposed to the minimum annual income.
Yeah, I'm just saying it won't work. You have to have a society with incentives and rewards, and life's about sacrifice. Life's about give and take, whether you're left, right, center, whatever.
Well, you know, I think that life contains sacrifice and does have some give and take, and I wouldn't set a national minimum income at $40,000. I would set it at $10,000. So, some people will choose to live at that or below it. Other people will go beyond it. That would be my response, Armin. Armin, thank you for the call. Bob, you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, and Clayton in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hey, Clayton, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I say we need an asthmatic settlement. The polluters kill the earth and are richly rewarded. I have exceptionally severe asthma and now high blood pressure, uncontrolled diabetes, gallbladder issues and things like that, all from the, over 40 years of medicines, you know. I take 20 pills a day.
Ouch.
And I live in poverty. So I have an IQ of 136, but my income is down at the very, very bottom of income in the United States. I mean, it's as close as you can get. I was a top student. Anyway, how can we get this going, an asthmatics settlement, some kind of a class action suit,
right?
Asthmatics versus the polluters, because they've basically killed us. And
asthma has exploded in the United States over the past 50 years. There, interestingly, the air was far more polluted 50 years ago than it is now, and for the 50 years preceding that. And asthma was rising, but not like it has in the last 50 years. And so there are some epidemiologists, and in fact, there's a whole chapter about this in a book I wrote called Threshold. Some epidemiologists are suggesting that it's not so much the pollution that's causing asthma as it is the body. Asthma is a autoimmune response. It's the body, you know, thinking that it's attacking the pollution, but it ends up attacking the body itself and destroying cells. And that's the consequence of our not having parasites. That back when we had, typically kids would get pinworms, people had hookworms, people had, various kinds of parasites. These parasites live in the intestine and they produce chemicals that down-regulate the human immune system so that we don't expel them, and we co-evolved with them. These parasites are found in virtually every Homo species and primate species all the way down to lemurs. There are parasites like this, and we have we've dewormed ourselves in the last 50 years, and that's causing the asthma. Now that is something that you might want to look into, number one. And number two, I say that because I actually know a fellow who now had to leave the United States, moved to the UK, who makes a living selling parasites to people to take therapeutically. And again, I wrote about him in my book. And he's curing people of asthma and helping people with MS and all kinds of, you know, these autoimmune disorders. It's really quite remarkable. Now, that's one category of response. The other category is, yes, these polluters are destroying the earth, and it's not just causing asthma. It's causing storms and taking out cities and things like that. And so I think that the first thing we have to do is identify the fact that there is a cost to carbon pollution, and that ranges from asthma and cancer on the health side to things like, you know, global warming and Superstorm Sandy on the planetary side. And we need to associate a real cost with that carbon. And it should start out at probably $10 or $15 a ton and go up by $10 every year or two until it gets to over $100 a ton, at which point it's reflecting its real cost. And that will cause us as a society to move away from carbon-based fuels and then cycle all that money back to we the people, so everybody gets a check, just like in Canada, everybody gets a $2,000 a year check from the Alaska, from the Alaska Permanent Fund, cycle that money back as a check to everybody in the country so that people can, you know, afford to pay for more expensive gasoline and afford to pay for, you know, moving from a gas-driven car to an electric car, for example. Am I making sense, Clayton?
Yes, but I was wondering if there's any way we can initiate something right away. I don't know how much time I have left living. And
that's a question for somebody like Mike Papantonio. He does that kind of thing for a living.
I did call their office already. They're swamped with BP cases.
Yeah, that's right. He's working on that right now.
But I was going to say, at one point, I felt that asthma is kind of like, kind of like the opposite of AIDS, because AIDS is kind of like a declining immune system, and asthma is an overactive immune system.
That's correct.
So overactive, it'll kill us by closing down our breathing.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And that's why I'm not offering advice to you personally, but I would say anybody who's confronting that should Google autoimmune therapies and helminthic, H-E-L-M-I-N-T-H-I-C therapy, because I have personally know people who have had severe asthma. I mean, just like, potentially lethal severe asthma, who have been cured, if that's the correct word, by the judicious and careful. And by the way, these are prescribed in the German healthcare system. They've little eggs for these worms come in little bottles that look like drug vials, you know, and they're sterile and they're safe and all this kind of stuff.
My goal is a financial disincentive for polluting.
Yes.
I'm getting into clean energy faster.
I'm absolutely with you on that. And I don't know that you can, I just don't know where to begin on that. Other than working toward a carbon tax, I think that there are so many wrongs that are being perpetrated by these companies that we just need to be screaming about it. Clayton, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for listening to AM760. I appreciate it. And I know my going off on worms sounds totally creepy. But, hey, check it out. You'll discover I'm not crazy. A Roman walks into a bar and asks for a martinis. "You mean a martini?" the bartender asks. The Roman replies, "If I wanted a double, I would have asked for it." I told that joke yesterday, didn't I? Okay, we got other jokes. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll be picking up your calls as we continue with Anything Goes Friday. Minutes before the hour, occupying the media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Joan in Elk Creek, Virginia. You wanted to talk about what happens when we die?
Yes, Tom, you were discussing this last week, and thank you for mentioning Thomas Sugrue's book, There is a River, about Edgar Cayce. It's a great book, and I think Edgar Cayce was one of the most amazing people who has lived in our time. My comment was, you were talking about most people talk about going toward the light when they get ready to pass on. And my husband spent most of his adult life studying past life regression work, and he guided people to their past lives. And whenever he asked them what happened when they died, they would always say that they went toward a light. And these people, it didn't matter if they were religious or not, or what part of the world they were from. And I just think that's probably more than a coincidence. And I appreciate your discussing that.
Well, thank you. That was your point? That's what you wanted to say?
Yeah, I just think that this is something that is very common, and maybe people don't realize it, but that seems to be.
Yeah, and whether it's that the visual cortex is the last part of the brain to shut down, and it's just firing, or because it's the largest part of the brain, or whether it's that we're suddenly, as our senses shut down, our extra senses, our extrasensory senses kick in. I don't know, but I agree with you that this is a very common experience. The thing that I find most fascinating are the reincarnation stories that children tell before the age of 5. There has been some really, really good research. There's several books about this. Really good research where they have found kids who are before the what's called the second great demyelination, which Joseph Chilton Pierce writes about in The Magical Child, which happens around the age of 6 or 7, where the brain loses a whole bunch of brain matter in an attempt to sculpt the brain and make it more efficient. Prior to that, children experience the world very differently than they do after that. And these young children who remember previous lives and can provide details like where they lived or how they died, and very often how they died is associated with some mark on their body. You know, I was shot with a bullet in the middle of the back, and in the middle of the back they've got a birthmark now, or whatever. And these are just absolutely remarkable stories, so I commend them to you. Joan, thank you for the call. I want to get as many in as I can here. David, in Mamaroneck, that's not how you say it.
Mamaroneck, New York.
Okay. So what's up, David?
Yes, hi. I was just calling it, was listening to Bernie, and I read his budget proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, or actually I'd like to see this in the Sanders administration. The Federal Reserve and the Treasury can buy our trading partners' dollars. And by doing so, we could make the dollar weaker and give ourselves an advantage where we wouldn't have to tax or put tariffs on our trading partners.
We have tried that in the past. There have been times, I'd have to go back and look up who did it and when, but there have been times when it was the policy of the U.S. government to weaken the dollar, or the policy of the Fed collaboratively with the administration to weaken the dollar to improve our trade position in the world. There have been times when we've strengthened the dollar too, which arguably changes the dynamic domestically. I think this is called a monetarist approach to trade, or, you know, adjusting trade imbalances through monetary policy. And I think it's a mistake, because monetary policy is it's like going after a fly with a sledgehammer. Monetary policy swings all kinds of things in the nation, and trade is just one of them. And I think if you want to change your trade policy, you should simply change your trade policy. Use either a VAT tax, like the Germans, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Taiwanese, the South Koreans do, where you tax every step of production, and then you reverse that tax out on export, and anything that gets imported, you add a VAT tax to it. So, you know, you have a functional tariff in both directions. Or just be honest and have tariffs like we did from the George Washington administration to the Reagan administration. Or have the Japanese are particularly good at this, and the Chinese increasingly, have restrictive import regulations that specify that goods can only be imported if they meet certain standards, so standards that exporting countries find very, very hard to meet. There's a variety of ways to do that. David, thank you for the call. Mark in Chico, California. Hey, Mark.
Hi.
You want to talk about a Christian group offering a reward to kill the president?
Yes.
Seriously.
The site is under Freak Out Nation, and it's a Christian American Patriots militia leader offer a reward for President Obama's capture, dead or alive. And with the Secret Service getting drunk all over the place, which probably isn't true, but I reported this to the FBI and the Secret Service, and this site is still up. Now, I understand free speech, but I don't think this is free speech. So I would like your what you think about this.
It's against the law to threaten the president. It's against the law to encourage someone to kill the president, to the best of my knowledge. And, it's possible that this site has phrased this in such a way that it either is considered or presented as satire, or although even that, it's like try making a joke while you're standing in the TSA line. Either they're doing it as satire, which is a protective speech, or the federal government has just decided that this group isn't worth going after, or they just haven't gotten around to it yet. I mean, you know, sometimes the wheels of justice grind slowly. But Mark, you might want to call the FBI and the Secret Service up and follow up and say, you know, this site is still up and they're still threatening the president, and it concerns me. But Mark, thanks for the call. It's say what? Oh, okay. Shane just checked this out, and he said that post has been taken down. So the site is still up, yeah, but the post calling for the death of the president is gone. So maybe Mark, they have done what you wanted. Patricia in Sacramento. Hey, Patricia, you want to talk about the IMF loan in the Ukraine?
Yes, sir, if I may. Just quickly, I wanted to point to an article in Bloomberg News that talked about the $18 billion bailout to Ukraine. And I hope I want to lead into just quickly to the conservative gentleman that called about why raising wages was a bad idea. First, talking about Ukraine, it's interesting because when I read this, apparently $6 to $7 billion of this money is going to the Western banks. So this mess that happened in Ukraine, which is very similar to Greece and Italy and here at home, these risks the bank took, they lost this money. So now this money is going to go, part of it, and to the Western banks. And then the other parts are going to be, they're going to be cutting things like pensions, federal workers. So they're basically going to pull a Greece.
Right. They're imposing austerity. And the rest of the money, by the way, is going to Russia because, you know, Ukraine owes Russia a whole pile of money right now.
Correct. And it's sad because when you look at this, it's kind of like what you said, Tom. How do you pay debt off with more debt?
Exactly.
You know, Greece is just sinking deeper and deeper. I have family there, Tom. It is devastating what has happened to Greece. There are people eating out of garbage cans. There's poverty everywhere. It's the saddest thing to see. But how I want to touch on your last caller is that, you know, the bailout that the banks got, how they destroyed every economy around the world, it's astounding to me that these people think that raising wages will destroy the economy, but they cannot see the damage that the banks have done. That's what's destroyed the economy.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at it, it's on a global scale, and that includes China.
Yeah.
And it is devastating,
yeah.
And it keeps spiraling downward.
Yeah,
so I just wanted to throw that out there, and I recommend that everybody look at Robert Reich's Inequality for All.
Yes, it's a great movie.
Documentary. It is fascinating. It's wonderful to see how what has happened to our wages. I just wanted to tie that on quickly, Tom. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened to our wages? As costs have gone up, our wages have stayed the same or gone down.
Right.
You cannot support an economy when you're doing that.
Yeah.
And Tom, I know you're really short on time. If I may, one last thing. The gentleman did not understand that he thinks that these are jobs at 7-Eleven that pay these small wages. I worked for five different banks as a supervisor, and I got paid what I would consider poverty wages, $14 an hour living in California as a supervisor for a bank.
Right.
I worked in the mortgage industry. I worked as a paralegal. These jobs pay under $16 an hour, which you cannot survive in California.
Yeah.
So how can he explain that? A job that requires skills paying poverty wages.
Yeah. And the way that the employers get away with it is because there's such a large pool of people who will work for, there's probably people who would work as a manager in a bank for $10 an hour.
Absolutely, Tom. And it's just,
and that's why
not understand these jobs require skills. They require good judgment.
Yeah.
And they still pay you poverty wages.
And that's why the government should be the employer of last resort. This is something
that
Franklin Roosevelt proposed in 1944, and when he proposed his Second Bill of Rights, that we built into the Constitution that you have the right to a job that is a decently remunerative job. In other words, you have the right to a job and a job that pays reasonably. And that if capitalism can't provide that job, government will. And I'm so with FDR on that. And we just haven't even had a conversation about it since 1945. Patricia, thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to iHeartRadio. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. June in Shawano, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, June, what's up?
Hi, I have a joke for you, kind of to put off some of the sadness of your last caller.
Okay.
Okay, Einstein and Newton are walking down the road. All of a sudden, there appears another man. Newton looks at Einstein and said, "Who's that?" Einstein said, "That's Descartes." And Newton looks at him and says, "What are you, a magician?" Einstein says, Descartes says, "No, monsieur, I think, therefore I am."
Okay, I have a variation on that for you.
Okay.
Which, let me just see if I've got it right here. Jean-Paul Sartre, it's pronounced Sartre, isn't it? Or is it Sartre?
Sartre.
Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre is sitting at a French cafe revising his draft of being and nothingness. He says to the waitress, "I'd like a cup of coffee, please. No cream." The waitress replies, "I'm sorry, monsieur, but we're out of cream. How about with no milk?" Ba-dum-bum. You don't get it? Shane doesn't get it either. It's being and nothingness, right? He says, "I want it with no cream. I want it with a negative."
No cream.
And so she says, "We're out of cream, so can I give it to you with no milk?" All right. When you have to explain a joke, it's no good.
That's okay.
Yeah, okay. So that's what you call to share a joke with me. Thank you, June. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye now. Victoria in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, Victoria, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Hi. Well, quickly, I got a new topic because of, I was listening to them talking about dying, and I just wanted to say that I've spoken to several people who have, you know, died and come back, had those near-death experiences, and they all said that it was a wonderful, glorious experience.
Yes, that was my mother's description, too.
Yeah, there's no reason to fear dying. You know, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Also, I've read some stuff of Edgar Cayce, and basically he was saying that we don't realize it, but we all choose when we are going to be born and when we die. It's up to us, and it's already set. But anyway, but the real thing I wanted to talk about was what Michael Hudson was saying last night about Ukraine and all that, because basically he kind of confirmed what I thought, and it's just, it's about this worldwide oligarchy. They're all connected now, you know?
Yep.
And I thought that's why the UK or the EU was not protesting like hell at first about Ukraine, was because all the EU oligarchs are connected to the Russian oligarchs and the Ukrainian oligarchs with business deals, trade ties, and arms deals, and all this kind of stuff. And so what happens keeps happening, what I see in all these...
Right, and not only that, but I have seen commentaries in financial publications suggesting that that's a good thing, that all these oligarchs having these interconnected relationships, and this is the argument that was made for kings and kingdoms back 200 years ago, that these, and why all the families of Europe, all the kings and queens of Europe were cousins of each other. By being interconnected, it reduces the probability of war. I think it's a nonsensical argument, but they're still making it. Thank you, Victoria. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to the great folks at all the various organizations that syndicate this program, Westwood One on commercial radio, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial radio, Sirius XM satellite radio across the nation, cable radio network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work with us on The Big Picture, the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, and to Jacob and Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, our radio and television stations, to our sponsors and underwriters, and to you for supporting our program and supporting the way that you get this program, supporting the networks or the stations that you are hearing or seeing or both me on, us on. Thank you so much. You make it possible. You really do. Okay. Dasha in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Dasha, what's up?
Hey, I just had a very quick question, and I'll get off air.
Okay.
I've been listening to all of this talk about trying to get money out of politics. I'm hearing it from multiple people. You're talking about it. Young Turks are talking about it. And I'm just trying to get an idea about the different plans. There's MoveOn.org, which you've talked about, and then there's Wolfpac. What's the difference? Thanks.
What's the difference between what and what?
MoveOn, or not MoveOn, I'm sorry. Wolfpack has their thing that they're trying to do to get money out of politics. You have one that you talk about.
Right.
What's the difference?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with Wolfpack. If you're talking about movetoamend.org is the one that I like. And I like them because they're clean. You know, it's very, very simple. I had a fellow on from Public Citizen a week or so ago, one of their guys, and they're saying, let's do away with corporate personhood for for-profits, but not for nonprofits, because we're a nonprofit. And I'm like, no, do away with corporate personhood for everything, because if you leave it there for nonprofits, you know, Karl Rove is running one of the biggest nonprofits in the country. The Koch brothers are running all kinds of nonprofits. That's not going to solve anything. So I have not found any organization other than movetoamend.org that is offering what I consider to be a clean and comprehensive solution. I know that the unions don't like it because they want to be exempted. They want to have personhood. And I'm saying, no, nobody should have personhood except human beings. And this is one of the problems in the movement is that, you know, you get these folks who are going, well, let's do it halfway. And I'm like, we're going to have one chance. And if we don't do it right, it's going to come back and bite us in the butt. Dasha, thanks for the call. Chris in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Chris, thanks for listening to 1320. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Good to speak
with you. Or 1230 a.m. I'm sorry.
Yeah, 1230. I've been looking at a lot of the polls lately and for the unemployment extension. And, you know, some of them looking at, most of them are in the 60 to 70% range of the populace to extend it. How does Congress just ignore the will of the people over and over and over again?
Yeah, 60 to 70% of Americans think that you know, Medicare should be available to everybody. 60 to 70% of Americans think Social Security should be strengthened, not weakened. 60 to 70, 80% of Americans, you know, think that we should reduce the size of our military dramatically. I mean, you know, we could go on and on. You know, 60, 70, 80% of Americans think that really, really rich people should pay higher taxes and that they shouldn't. And probably 90% of Americans think that Wall Street banksters should not have this carried interest loophole where they pay a maximum 21% income tax when a brain surgeon pays 39%. I mean, you know, the reason why the politicians are ignoring the will of the people is because the Supreme Court has set up a system where the politicians don't anymore answer to the people. They answer to the money. And the politicians are paying very careful attention to their constituents, and they are doing exactly what the constituents want. The problem is that over the last 40 years, as a consequence of a series of Supreme Court decisions, the constituents of the politicians have gone from being average working people to being oligarchs, to being the billionaires in our society. And that's what, and the only way we can fix that, in my opinion, is by amending the Constitution to turn back the Supreme Court's dastardly deeds by saying money is not speech and corporations are not persons. Chris, thanks for the call. Leon in Port Angeles, Washington. Hey, Leon.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I heard the word education, and I wanted to tell you about my wife, who has MS for 41 years.
Mm-hmm.
She took 9 years of interferons, and 18 consecutive trips to the doctor proved that she was progressive, according to the neurologist. We quit. I mean, we gave up. It was just hopeless, it seemed. I got a hold of this Edgar Cayce Wetzel battery idea.
Mm-hmm.
And 9 months after I started giving it to her, a neurologist said, you know, your wife is stable for the first time in 9 years. And we had now, what's the answer to that? Were the interferons poisoning her? Or did the Wetzel battery help her because she was, you know, progressive for all those years, and now she's stable with a Wetzel battery? We've been using it for 7 years. She's 70 years old.
Wow. Wow. That's remarkable. You know, the Edgar Cayce remedies, they're compiled. You can get this stuff from the Edgar Cayce Foundation. Some of them are truly remarkable. I don't want to go into too much detail here because it's I don't have the permission of my wife to share this. Louise had an issue, say, 20 years ago, and we tried an Edgar Cayce remedy, and it was the only thing that worked, and it was like a miracle. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. And there are, you know, I've heard these kind of stories from so many people, so Leon, thanks for calling and sharing that story. There's something to it. The Edgar Cayce remedies are there's something to it. And, you know, things like, you know, putting, I'm out of time. Look it up. Look it up. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.